I've listened to Bad Motorfinger by Soundgarden for months.
And I listened to it once yesterday.
Welcome to Spin It. Everybody, and welcome back to Spin It, the Record Ranking Podcast for people who would rather be listening to music. I'm James, and with me, way over there, that's Connor.
I'm so far away. Oh, hang on, let me run over to where you are.
Hey, how's it going? Sorry I was so far away.
That's okay. You're here now, and that's what matters.
I was out in my sound garden.
Do you have a garden of sound?
Yeah.
What's it sound like?
Nature.
So just the normal garden? It's just the sound of a normal garden?
All gardens are sound gardens if you're listening.
Deep. That's deep.
Deep thoughts with Connor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking about Soundgarden this week. Going back to the Seattle grunge scene, I'm really curious to get your thoughts on this and mostly how it compares to, like, Nevermind. Maybe the Foo Fighters to a lesser extent, but yeah, mostly, you know, Soundgarden, Nirvana, they kind of ran in the same circles, being in the same genre from the same city.
Yeah, that's probably the closest we've come to Nirvana since doing Nirvana. Way back in, like, episode 4?
Yeah, episode 4.
I know when our episodes come out. I've never said otherwise.
It's definitely the closest. I mean, even if we've come close before, definitely the closest, which is exciting. Do you know anything about Soundgarden? Do you know any big hits? Black Hole Sun?
Yeah, no. I know Black Hole Sun. I didn't know that was by Soundgarden. I could not have told you who sung that song. I'm also a little disappointed we're not doing that one.
Yeah.
Mainly because I know that song and I like that song, but...
Sure. Well, this is about exposure, but also when I was looking into getting into Soundgarden for the first time, the internet's popular opinion seemed to be that Bad Motorfinger was the better album than Super Unknown. So I was like, sure, why not? I'll go for it. You know, I'll try something different.
Fair enough. But yeah, Black Hole Sun is probably by far their most popular song, and it's transcended them a little bit. It shows up on a lot of, like, greatest rock song playlists.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny because Black Hole Sun feels fundamentally so different than most of what's on Bad Motorfinger, I think. But yeah, I'm stoked. I've really enjoyed reintroducing this album to myself over the last couple weeks, just getting ready for the episode and Googling and listening, and it's been nice. It's been a process. But let's get into it. Soundgarden was officially formed in 1984. So I think that means they predate Nirvana a little bit, and their primary run lasted up until 1997. They also had another stint from 2010 to 2018, but they officially disbanded after the untimely death of founder guitarist and, of course, iconic vocalist Chris Cornell. It all started back in the early 1980s. Chris Cornell was in a band called The Shemps. What a band name.
That's an interesting name.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Three Stooges. Well, Cornell's in The Shemps, and he's in The Shemps alongside bassist Hiro Yamamoto and eventually Kim Thayil. They had connections to Bruce Pavitt, who would eventually found the Seattle-based grunge-forward record label Sub Pop, who we've talked about many a time now.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah, that would be a very important connection for Soundgarden in the future. But Cornell, Yamamoto, and Thayil start jamming on their own once The Shemps broke up, right? Chris Cornell is on the drums at that point. Eventually, he'd be replaced on the drums by Matt Cameron so he could spend more time focusing on his vocals. They called that little trio Soundgarden, and it was actually named after, I mean, you joke, but it's named after an actual garden of sound.
Yeah.
It was an art installation by Doug Hollis on the northwest shore of Lake Washington.
In? Isn't that in Seattle?
Yeah, it's in Seattle.
Yeah. Apparently, the physical art installation became kind of a makeshift memorial for Chris Cornell after his death.
Yeah.
In 2017.
Yeah, it's still around, and you can visit it today. It's made of organ pipes on weather vanes, so when the wind blows, it actually sounds maybe just like that. You won't know unless you go see it.
Maybe it sounds like bah, 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 bah.
Oh, like that Phantom of the Opera kind of organ?
Yeah, I don't
know. It could be Phantom of Seattle. So they're playing as an art-named trio. They start to be managed by Cornell's future wife, Susan Silver.
Great name.
Susan Silver? It sounds like a superhero, like a secret identity.
Oh, yeah, like the secret identity of a superhero, right?
Yeah.
Susan Silver is... I immediately went to the Silver Surfer, but that doesn't make sense.
No.
But you know, like I don't know, Susan Silver is like a Clark Kent kind of name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some of the band's early demos got picked up by DJ Jonathan Poneman. He said, this band was everything rock music should be. He loved what they were doing. He loved them so much that he offered them enough money to fund a release.
Whoa.
He contributed $20,000 to this little trio of guys. And the band said, hey, you should get in touch with Bruce Pavitt, right? This guy we know, he's good with music. And that $20,000 is what he used to found Sub Pop. And Soundgarden became their first official flagship artist. Their first record, Ultra Mega OK, was released on the indie label STT in late 1988. They were obviously very proud of it, but they had some regrets about going with a producer who was kind of an outsider. You know, he wasn't really in tune with the grunge scene in Seattle that they were a part of and hoping to appeal to, right? That their fan base was made up of. So after the record, they jumped ship and went to a more prominent major label, A&M Records, which actually made things worse. Their audience did not love it. They thought they were selling out. Kim Thayil says, our fans came from the punk rock crowd. They abandoned us when they thought we sold out the punk tenets, getting on a major label and touring with Guns N' Roses.
Oh no.
He said there were fashion issues and social issues and people thought we no longer belonged to their scene, to their particular subculture. But that's just optics. Obviously, they still did. It's just that when you're punk, you know, you gotta get with it. By 1990, Soundgarden would release a pair of EPs, Screaming Life and FOPP, F-O-P-P, and their second record and major label debut, Louder Than Love, actually peaked at number 108 on the Billboard charts, which is remarkable. That's when Hiro Yamamoto decided to step away from Soundgarden and go back to school. And can you guess who they brought in to replace him?
I sure can.
Yeah?
Oh, you actually want me to?
I
said I could. I didn't know that you actually wanted me to do that.
Yeah. Simon says, take a guess.
Simon doesn't control me.
Okay.
I'm ungovernable.
Okay.
I mean, I could take a guess. I didn't say be correct either.
That's fine. The whole fun of it is that I think you'll be incorrect.
Oh.
If I just thought you'd get it right, I'd just say it.
Was it Bill Nye the Science Guy?
No, it was not, but imagine what kind of a punk band that would be. No, in fact, they brought on Jason Everman, former Nirvana guitarist.
Oh!
The one credited on Bleach, who never played a single note. They're poaching Seattle's local legends.
Did he get to play a note on this one?
Actually, no. He got fired in 1990 and did not record a note for Soundgarden either.
Oh, no.
Which is actually not quite true.
Oh.
It's funny for the irony of saying he was a part of Nirvana and Soundgarden but never played a note. But actually, he did play on their cover of The Beatles Come Together on their Loudest Love EP. But that's it.
Ah.
Poor guy.
Barely got to play any notes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they fired him. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. In your contract, explicitly said you weren't allowed to play notes.
We hired you, but you can't play. Yeah, maybe that's what did it. Poor Jason Everman. Hey, Jason Everman, if you want to be on this podcast and not talk,
hey,
like, you're welcome.
Hey, Jason, play notes.
Yeah.
Instead of take notes.
Right. So he then was subsequently replaced by bassist Ben Shepherd, actually, who was one of Soundgarden's biggest fans at the time.
Whoa.
They said he was a fresh and creative musician and that he helped make their sound faster and weirder. So
I like weird.
Mm-hmm. You get some weird. Fast and Weird is kind of the name of the game.
That's the story of my life.
Yeah.
Fast and Weird.
Good. Then I guess Bad Motorfinger's a good jumping off point for you, because that is Soundgarden's lineup as they write and record for their third album and the subject of the podcast episode you're currently listening to, Bad Motorfinger. They wrote and recorded most of the album in early 1991. Critics have said that this record represents a quantum leap in focus and consistency compared to their previous work, which goes hand in hand with thematic maturity, instrumental precision, and really it's ultimately this ambitious attempt to kind of push the limits of grunge as a genre, which are all three like really key components of why this album stands out. They also took advantage of each other's skills and abilities more often. They wrote together collaboratively instead of just bringing songs. They kind of got in the room and hashed things out. A lot of the songs actually, I don't know if this is something you could tell, maybe it's like a non-instrumentalist, or it depends on how closely you were listening, but a lot of the songs
I'm feature, sorry you just call me a non-instrumentalist?
No, I'm saying it depends on how closely you were listening to the album and how familiar you are.
I'm pretty certain you just said, I don't know, as a non-instrumentalist, if you picked up.
When was the last time you played an instrument?
Just the other day.
When was the other day?
Like, over the weekend?
Really?
Yeah, I got my keyboard.
Oh, well, but I'm talking guitars.
Last time I did that, a couple months ago.
Okay.
Well, and I mean, I played the trumpet for years.
Right, but the trumpet's not going to help you hear a guitar that's tuned differently.
How dare you? You and your biases. That is a hurtful stereotype that trumpets can't identify guitar tuning subtleties.
Okay.
I mean, it's just hurtful to all trumpet players out there.
Sorry.
I need you to issue a formal apology to all trumpet players.
I'm sorry, all trumpet players.
You should be.
What I'm saying is, a lot of their songs feature unique guitar tunings.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, sometimes they lower the E string, sometimes as far as a fifth to a drop B tuning.
Whoa, a whole fifth?
A whole fifth.
Can't believe I didn't pick up on that.
I can't believe it either. It's so obvious.
Hey, no.
I'm just kidding. One thing you might have noticed if you tried to count along with these songs is time signatures get a little amorphous.
I am sensitive to time signatures as a marching band guy.
Yeah, did you have fun with this album in that regard then?
Yeah, it was weird. Fast and weird
and all over the place. Outshined, for example, switches into 7/4. Face Pollution uses 9/8. Like, these are weird time signatures that don't happen much, but they happen much here. It's very a condensed period of time changes. And lyrically also, Chris Cornell evolves and tries to be more abstract. So he moves away from a lot of details and specific lyrics, and he kind of goes towards high concept songs full of what he says are colorful images. Thayil will go on to say that Bad Motorfinger is like reading a novel about man's conflict with himself and society, or the government, or his family, or the economy, or anything. Basically, a man in conflict. You may be asking yourself, what is Bad Motorfinger? What's that name? What's that mean? Where does it come from? As a matter of fact, it was more or less a joke. It was Kim Thayil's parody of the song Bad Motor Scooter by Montrose. He said it was sort of off the top of my head. I simply like it because it was colorful and kind of aggressive too. It conjures up a lot of different images. We like the ambiguity in it, the way it sounded and the way it looked. What do you think? Do you like the way it sounds? Bad Motor Finger?
It is kind of cool.
It's unique. A one-of-a-kind portmanteau. I think it's one of the clunkiest combinations of band name and album title that we've had yet.
Yeah, it's a bit clunky.
Bad Motor Finger by Soundgarden. A lot of syllables, a lot of hard consonants. But I think that kind of is what makes it work. The whole album is a little abrasive, and it's only fitting that the title kind of jerks you around a little bit too. They recorded Bad Motor Finger in Woodinville, Washington, and in California, and it came out on October 8th, 1991, after a couple of delays due to production problems. And that timing, 1991... I mean, is a huge deal for grunge music. There's this massive wave of albums that come out within like 2 months of each other, right? There's Nevermind by Nirvana, Pearl Jam's 10, Blood Sugar Sex Magik by the Red Hot Chili Peppers all came out in the same window. And that big wave is really kind of credited with the mainstreamification of grunge and hard rock music. They're a key part of it. Generally, I think the perception is that Soundgarden, at this time, did get outdone in the public eye by Nirvana, right? Kurt Cobain and Nirvana is a highly visible band. But overall, Nevermind ended up drawing a lot of attention to the Seattle punk scene in general. And so, you know, kind of a rising tide lifted all boats. And Soundgarden got a lot more fans from people that otherwise might not have looked at the Seattle grunge scene. But that's not to say that it wasn't popular on its own, right? Bad Motorfinger got its fair share of awards in its day. It was actually nominated for a Best Metal Performance Grammy, and it won a Northwest Area Music Award for Best Metal Album. It would go on to be Guitar World's 45th Best Album of All Time in 2006, and in 2019, Rolling Stone awarded it runner-up on its 50 Greatest Grunge Albums. Can you guess what number one was?
Was it Nirvana?
It was Nevermind. Yeah, it was runner-up to Nevermind. But it did beat out 10 and Pearl Jam, and Siamese Dream by the Smashing Pumpkins is down at number 12. When did we talk about that? Episode 14, I think, was the Smashing Pumpkins? We did a lot of that early. Bad Motorfinger also sent Soundgarden on a North American tour and earned them an opening slot for Guns N' Roses and later Skid Row. In 2016, Bad Motorfinger even got a deluxe and a super deluxe 25th anniversary release.
Ooh.
Yeah, it had outtakes, it had live tracks, and a lot more. They even put out 1,000 copies on silver vinyl. And actually, when they set about trying to remake and remaster this project for the anniversary, they had to use digital backups to get that all figured out because Bad Motorfinger was yet another victim of that massive Universal Studios fire in 2008.
Oh, wow.
That destroyed so many original source materials. Have we talked about that before?
I don't think so.
I feel like we have to have.
I don't think it's come up.
I don't know. We've talked about several artists that have been affected by it. It's an impossibly long list. The Wikipedia page has dozens on dozens on dozens of entries, but a few of the highlights and people that we've kind of talked about include Aerosmith, B.B. King, Quincy Jones, remember him?
Yeah. No.
Oh, I knew it. Elton John, George Strait, the Eagles, tons of people lost masters and original material and stuff in this fire, which is so wild. But that's kind of the Bad Motorfinger era. As far as the rest of Soundgarden's career, it paved the way for them to release their fourth record, Super Unknown, which is actually, that's where Black Hole Sun comes from, of course, and it's their most successful record. Pretty much considered their mainstream breakthrough, right? Where they break out of the strictly grunge pocket. That one sent them on a world tour, a tour so intense, in fact, that it almost permanently damaged Chris Cornell's vocal cords. But then after their fifth record, Down on the Upside, tensions got a little high on another frustrating, long world tour. By the time it wrapped up in 1997, Soundgarden announced that they would be officially disbanding. For the most part, they went on to do other solo projects and other work. Notably, Chris Cornell joined Audioslave for 3 albums until their breakup in 2007. Kim Thayil worked with Nirvana's Chris Novoselic and later with Dave Grohl. The band officially did come back together, though, in 2010, and they put out one more studio album, 2012's King Animal, and they were actually still actively touring and had ambitions to record even more. But Chris Cornell's death, which rocked the music world pretty significantly, if you remember, led to the band's ultimate end. They only came together one other time for a tribute to Chris Cornell in early 2019. Do you remember when Chris Cornell died?
Why would I remember that?
Well, because it was a big deal. I feel like maybe you weren't as plugged in. I don't know. I followed music a lot.
I don't think I'm that plugged in the music now.
Okay, touche. Well, I saw it everywhere. I just saw a lot of talk about it.
Yeah, I've heard the mixtape as an interesting Chris Cornell fact coming up on Factor Spin.
I would hope so. I guess we'll have to find out very shortly. They've also officially retired the Soundgarden name now. And actually, I learned that there is still a lot of turmoil. They ended up in a lot of legal trouble with Chris's estate and his widow. She's gone back and forth with the band about the rights and ownership of a couple different unreleased works that Cornell was a part of. They sued and countersued each other several times over 6 years until finally, actually, in 2023, they announced that 7 unreleased tracks featuring Chris Cornell would be released in the future. So that's kind of interesting. As far as awards and accolades for Soundgarden go, they were huge for grunge and heavy rock music. It's hard to overstate their legacy and their impact. They were really pioneers and influences on so many people that play similar music to this day. You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone playing hard rock that doesn't revere Chris Cornell and Soundgarden. They were nominated for 9 Grammys and won 2 of them. They also earned an MTV Video Music Award for Black Hole Sun, and in total, they earned 7 Northwest Area Music Awards in the span of 2 years. They were also nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for the first time in 2020, but they failed to be inducted so far. So keep an eye out for future.
Failed?
Yeah, they didn't make it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yet.
I don't know if that's, it's not like they tried and failed. They haven't made it. There's a lot of things I haven't done. I don't know if I would say I failed at them.
No, but they were nominated and failed to gain entry on the nomination.
Fair enough.
I wouldn't say you failed to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame either.
But I've been nominated.
No, you haven't. Don't lie.
You're right. That's not my job.
It's not your job to be nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? No.
No, to lie.
Oh, to lie. You're right. That's not your job either. But it is the job of the mixtaper. Is he ready? Is he gearing up for another couple rounds of Factor Spin?
Oh, he's ready.
Uh-oh. That means I'm not. It's, again, inversely proportional. The more confident and happy he is about a week, the more scared I am.
it's a weird week.
It's fast and weird. Fast and weird week this time.
Yeah, faster and weird.
Let's get the mixtape run out here for some fast and weird factor spin.
Hey, it's me, the mixtape.
Hello. How you doing?
Fast and weird.
As usual. Are we going to play Fast Fire Facts today, if it's fast and weird?
No, but I wish we were. I mean, we could in a weird way. Maybe we'll do a bonus, not for any points, Fast Fire Fact, in honor of it being fast and weird.
Okay, we'll see how we feel at the end, I guess. Do you like Soundgarden? How do you feel about grunge music? I guess I never ask you.
Yeah, I love Connor's Soundgarden.
No, not the garden that sounds like nature.
Oh.
Like Soundgarden the band. Grunge music.
They're okay.
Okay, it's okay. Okay,
let's get into it.
Yeah, let's.
We'll start with what I think is the mildest of these fast and weird facts.
Okay, and we'll see if it's true or if it's a lie, from mild to spiciest.
Yamamoto had a interesting degree.
Is it 98.6?
That's not very interesting.
Well, it's kind of interesting that that's the specific temperature of a human body.
Yeah, true.
But you're probably talking like a degree from school.
Sure am.
Okay, that's better. What did he study?
A degree in cryptozoology.
Cryptozoology, like cryptids?
I mean, I guess those would fall under this category.
Yeah, like Bigfoot, Big Feet, and the Loch Ness Monster.
Cryptozoology is the study of mythical, legendary, and undiscovered animals whose existence or survival is disputed. That's the end of that sentence.
Okay.
I realized I didn't end it in a way that made it sound like the end of the sentence, but it is.
So, like, unicorns?
Yeah. The field also requires that its members study and continuously apply new scientific discoveries towards the discovery of new hybrid creatures.
Hybrid creatures like jackalopes? What?
I don't. That's just what it says.
But how can you contribute?
I'm reading this from the university description of the degree.
Where did he get? Yeah, good question. Where did he get this degree from?
Western Washington University.
Okay. Is that an accredited school? Is this like a legitimate degree, or is this a joke thing, like a quack thing?
No, I mean, it's a real degree you can get.
Yeah, but like, what do I have to do to get it? Do I go take actual like zoology classes and biology? Like, am I learning about genetics and habitats and real things, or is it like mythos?
To become a cryptozoologist, you must sign up for a biology, anthropology, zoology, botany, or any other field related to animal science and take the cryptozoology discipline within that degree.
Okay, that sounds pretty legit.
So it sounds like he has a degree in something else and
with a cryptozoology focus.
Yeah.
Okay. What does he do with
you it? Also have to earn the respect of other serious researchers to serve as a kind of credentialing process. Don't know what that means.
Yeah. What contributions has he made to the field, I guess, if that's the thing he's required to do?
Students study and research their choice of a reported cryptid with a focus on objective ground research.
What cryptid did he choose?
I do not know. Simply know he has that degree.
He's got a cryptid degree. I'm gonna call this one a spin. Washington is famous for its Bigfoot sightings and like fabled things. And I mean, of course, as a Washington native, that's probably maybe why he'd get a degree in it. But also, I think you'd want to find a reason to lie about Bigfeet.
Yeah. Yeah. A guy that lives where the
Bigfoot are.
Yeah. Yeah. All I'll say is that is not the logic behind this, if it is indeed a spin. But don't let it influence your answer.
I'm still saying it's a spin.
Your justification is wrong, but you may still be right.
I think I am still right. It's just so coincidental. Bigfoot's everywhere in the Pacific Northwest. Not actual Bigfoot, but Bigfoot memorabilia and like merch and Bigfoot like knickknacks. It's prevalent. I feel like we couldn't go back to Seattle and not talk about Bigfoot.
Okay, fair enough. I have a question. Would you have believed this if I had said toy designer instead of cryptozoologist?
If he was a toy designer?
If he had a degree in toy design.
Yeah, I maybe would have believed it a little more.
What about snake milker?
I would have had a hard time believing snake milker, but I guess it depends on how you framed it.
More or less than cryptozoologist is really what I'm looking for.
Toy maker, more. Snake milker, less.
Flavor chemist?
Why are you doing this?
Or like flavor chemistry?
Like a flavor chemist.
Flavor chemist would be the job title. Flavor chemistry would be the degree.
I'd believe that at about the same level as cryptozoology.
Okay. Those are in the list of most unusual STEM careers. This is a spin.
Yeah, it is a spin. Okay, good.
But I'm annoyed. Like, I kind of feel like I got Otis elevated a little bit to a lesser degree, because like I just picked Cryptozoologist because it was the top of the list, not thinking at all that it had any, like, why do you know so much about Bigfoot where Bigfoot's most cited?
Well, that's
like how is that the path you went down?
Because Bigfoot's it's Seattle's famous for Bigfoot.
I don't know where Bigfoot is famous.
Well, nobody really knows where Bigfoot is famous, but at least they say they see him up there a lot.
That's what I said, it's to a lesser degree, but I feel like I somehow picked the worst option.
You did.
Snake Milker was really close to me picking, but I thought it'd be a hard sell.
It would have been.
He does, however, have a real degree from the Western Washington University, but it's a master's degree in physical chemistry.
Flavor science. See? That would have been super believable.
Similar. I thought about it. I thought about going that way, too.
That's cool.
But yeah.
Imagine, though, if he like left the band to go do school and decided to become a snake milker. That would have been a really hard sell.
It's interesting that you can get a degree in that, according to this.
Well, if you can get a license to hunt unicorns, you could do anything.
I see how that could be a job, but how do you make a whole degree out of being a snake milking degree? Like, what?
That's true.
All right, well, on to medium. We had our mild fact, now on to medium.
Okay.
Chris Cornell almost got a black hole named after him.
Darn it, I hate this, and it's so good. So, I'm guessing, I shouldn't guess, I should let you tell me. When I guess, sometimes you just agree with what I say.
No, go ahead, guess.
No.
Go ahead, guess.
No, go ahead, tell me.
No, please, go ahead.
So,
no, I refuse. I want you to guess.
So, I assume, you know, scientists, as they do, discovered a black hole.
Yeah.
And when they found it, they're like, oh, this is like that song, Black Hole Sun.
Kinda.
How so?
It wasn't the scientists. It was fans.
Oh, fans pressured the scientists into naming a black hole?
There was a whole petition for it.
The scientists said, hey, we found a new black hole, like BH1023.
I don't know if it was new.
Well, it's probably an old black hole, but newly found.
This was in 2019. When they finally photographed a black hole.
Oh, I remember that. That was an awesome picture.
Yeah, the photographed black hole, a bunch of fans started up a petition to have the black hole named after Chris Cornell.
Named after him, like inspired by him? Or do you want to name the black hole Chris Cornell?
The petition was started to use the black hole to honor Cornell and Black Hole Sun. They want to name the black hole after Chris Cornell. So yeah, I think they wanted to name the black hole Chris Cornell.
Look up into the sky. You can see. There he is, Chris.
There he is. Well, you can't see him, right? There's no light. That's like the whole point of a black hole.
You can see where he should be based on the absence of light.
It's a lot of absence of light in space.
So yeah, but why almost? Does the petition not get enough attention, or do scientists just flat refuse?
Yeah, I just think the petition didn't work.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I like this a lot. It seems too easy. Of course they do this, right?
That's for you to decide.
I'm going to say this is a fact. I remember that black hole picture.
Let me put it this way to you. One of the first things I did as a mixtaper when I saw we were doing this band was Google black holes named after Soundgarden. And it is now up to you to decide if I actually found any results or if I decided to make one up.
Yeah, I think this is totally legit. It's not too far after Chris Cornell passed away. He's fresh in the minds of the music-loving public.
It's a couple years, but yeah.
Of course you're going to try. It's the best picture of a black hole ever. I think this is true. I'm going to call it a fact.
Isn't it like the only picture of a black hole?
Yeah, that's why it's the most. Right.
Saying a fact?
Yeah, I'm saying a fact.
This is a true fact.
A true fact. Wow, Chris. It's Chris Cornell, the black hole, unofficially. That's how I know it now. Every time I see the picture, I'm going to go, there he is.
There he is. Good old Chris.
Chris, the black hole. It's not a black hole sun. It's a black hole.
Weren't most black holes formed from like a dying star or something? Which
yeah.
The sun is a star. So it kind of is.
Well.
All right. Up to hot.
Hot. Yeah, we got mild fact, medium fact. Hot fact?
Got a hot fact coming in.
Okay.
Spicy fact.
Spicy fact. Fast and weird.
There was an internet rumor that the band was secretly drug traffickers.
What?
That's what I said.
Who started this rumor?
I don't know who started it.
It's like a 4chan conspiracy? Like what?
That would not surprise me if that's where it started, but it exists. Several articles dedicated to debunking the internet rumor.
Yeah, so what evidence, in air quotes, are they citing for this? What's the reason people say this and or believe it?
From what I've gathered, I did not dive too deep into this mystery, but seems like there's some weird timelines that line up with like major drug activity in the US with like the places that they went. I guess.
Okay.
Like if you draw a heat map to like major drug busts, always like followed them coming to a city.
Well,
or
that...
I say always, but like, you know, they probably disregarded all the ones that didn't line up, right?
That's
but...
true. And if it's a drug bust, it probably implies the opposite.
Oh, maybe.
Maybe they're helping clean up the streets with all the drugs.
Oh, there's also, I saw one of the big things is that they think they were drug trafficking and money laundering for the organization, the Black Mafia family.
Why do they think that?
Because Bad Motorfinger would be BMF, which is what the Black Mafia family went by.
Okay.
And that was like an homage to it.
So some real Paul is Dead level digging here.
That's kind of what it seemed like. It was one of those things that like the conspiracy theorists, it was like a game to see how much you can make fit the theory sort of thing.
And they're just telegraphing it to the world. They're major drug traffickers who are making no attempts to conceal. Okay.
Apparently.
How'd this all end? I mean, other than articles debunking it.
Yeah, I mean, there's articles debunking it. I didn't find anything that was like a formal statement from the band, which is probably being used as incriminating evidence that they haven't spoken out against it.
Well, but... sure. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it still exists out there, so.
Yeah. I'm going to say this one is, obviously, they're not drug traffickers. That's not true.
Correct.
But this is just an internet rumor. There can be an internet rumor for almost anything. You had some really specific evidence about the acronyms in Bad Motorfinger. I feel like this could be an internet conspiracy. I think I'm going to say it's a fact.
This is a spin.
Oh, really? Oh, no.
Made it up.
Can I start an internet rumor for that point?
I just Googled BMF to see what would pop up because I was like, I wonder if I can do anything fun with like the acronym of the album.
Wow.
And when I typed in BMF, the only thing that pops up is just a bunch of stuff about like documentaries made about the Black Mafia family. It was all Black Mafia family stuff. And so then I was like, how can I like convince you that they were drug trafficking or money laundering? And I was like, I can't. So what's the next best thing? Convince you that people think that that is real.
Yeah, smart. That's smart. But by doing so, let me say this, by doing so, maybe you started the internet rumor.
Oh no.
Uh-huh.
What have I done?
Wow, that's wild. That was a very convincing fact. That's a good way to backtrack yourself into something believable.
All right, so we've had mild, medium, hot slash spicy. Time we go deadly with this.
Deadly?
Yeah. Deadly heat level.
Okay.
Chris Cornell's not in Kansas anymore.
Not in Kansas anymore?
It really doesn't tell you anything about what the fact's going to be about, but I couldn't think of a funny way.
No, that means I have to try and guess. So you do this all the time. You give me weird titles that supposed to like walk down the path to what the actual fact is.
It's a weird fact.
Chris Cornell's not in Kansas anymore.
Yep.
That's a reference to the Wizard of Oz.
Sure is.
Dorothy's not in Kansas anymore when she shows up.
Sure is. Who else isn't in Kansas anymore?
Well, hold on. We'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Toto's not in Kansas anymore. That's the whole, she says it to Toto.
True.
I don't understand. What's the deal? Does Chris Cornell have a dog named Toto? Where are we going with this?
No, but he's neighbors with a dog named Toto.
Chris, your fact is that Chris Cornell is neighbors with a dog named Toto?
Well, he's neighbors with Toto.
Toto.
But Toto's not home. Toto's not in Kansas anymore. Right. Or maybe he is in Kansas.
You're going to have to unpack this a lot more.
So Chris Cornell is buried in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Uh-huh.
And his grave is neighbors with a cenotaph for Toto, the dog from Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow. This is really something. Where's the Hollywood Forever Cemetery? Is it in California?
Yeah, it's 6000 Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Really?
90038.
Why is he buried there and not in Seattle or Washington in general?
This is where a bunch of famous people get buried.
And dogs.
His plot is 8SEC/AS8223.
Well, that's great. I don't know what you want me to do with that information right now.
I have a map to, I can get you directions directly to his plot if you'd like to visit.
Okay.
But yeah, he's grave neighbors with a Toto cenotaph.
But a cenotaph, that's not, Toto's not buried there.
Correct. A cenotaph is like an empty plot meant to be like a memorial for somebody who has died.
So he's not, so I see what you're saying when he...
Well, that's what I said, but that's why I said Toto's not...
He's not really neighbors with Toto.
I see Toto's not in Kansas anymore. He's not there.
Okay.
It says, this monument is dedicated to the memory of the beloved Toto from the 1939 film, The Wizard of Oz. After the death of Toto, originally named Terry in 1945, owner and trainer Carl Spitz buried the Carn Terrier. Is that a type of dog?
I don't know.
Carn Terrier on his ranch in Studio City. The 1958 construction of the Ventura Freeway destroyed her resting place.
Jeez.
Yeah, so this is like an honorary grave replacement.
Who else is he neighbors with?
Well, that's where fast-fired facts can come in.
Oh, I see.
If we'd like to play.
Gotcha. Who all's buried in this plot? Okay, sure, we can do that later. I think this is true. I think he's buried next to a memorial for Toto the dog. It's weird, though. The time gap is very strange. How that plot would be...
They're actually technically across the street neighbors as well, I should clarify.
Okay.
It's not like across the street, but like across the walkway, I guess, the path.
Sure.
If there's his, then there's a path.
And then there's Toto. That makes way more sense than like the dog died in the 1930s and like the monument was erected when?
I mean, it's still, I mean, considering how spread apart these graves are, because it's a bunch of famous people with like big statues and stuff on them.
Yeah.
They are oddly close to one another.
Yeah. I actually, when I was in Seattle, I saw a Chris Cornell statue outside their Museum of Modern Art.
Oh.
Very nice.
Nice. So you're saying this is true?
I think this is a fact. Yeah. I feel like there's no reason to disbelieve this. It, I guess, is just as likely that it's false, but how would you end up with this otherwise?
How do you think I ended up with this with it being true?
Touche. I mean, just you rambled off a series of numbers and letters that sounded like a legitimate grave location. So, I don't know. You've done some research. And
yeah, that's right. I did.
Should I be worried about that?
I don't know. You never know what a dastard like me might do.
Where's Toto's statue located?
944 North Van Ness Avenue, Los Angeles, California, 90038 is the street address, but the plot address, I gotta figure out how to pull that up.
You knew how to pull it up for Chris.
I don't know. Maybe as a cenotaph, it doesn't have an official plot number.
Because
I can't get it to pull up.
That actually could be true. Well, that's suspicious, but I'm gonna stick to my guns. I'm gonna lock in fact.
This is a true fact.
Hello.
Which means you win this week.
I really needed that.
It's been a minute.
Yeah, it has. Well, it was fast and weird.
It was fast and weird.
Not in Kansas anymore.
All right, so we want to play Fast Fire Facts, or?
Yeah, hit me with a few. I'm mostly just curious.
All right, first one, Crypt of Mickey Rooney. If you need to know who these people are, let me know.
Mickey Rooney? No, he's like every Santa Claus you've ever known from a claymation special. I think that's probably true. He's probably there, especially if Toto is there.
Well, this is meant to be like neighbors, just.
Oh.
What I'm considering neighbors is like general plots surrounding him. So it could be like two plots down or something like that, but in like the neighborhood of his plot.
Okay, nobody too far away.
All these people that I name will be buried there, whether or not he is.
That's hard. That's pointless. I'm glad this doesn't count for anything. Yeah, sure. Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, Mickey Rooney also is Gus in Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb.
Mm-hmm.
I never know who you know.
I know Mickey Rooney a little bit. Also, Mickey Rooney was like, he worked closely with Judy Garland a couple times, right? So if Toto's there, maybe.
So are you saying yes or no to that one?
Yeah, I'm saying yes.
Oh, yes. That one is correct.
Yes.
The cenotaph of Hattie McDaniel.
Hattie McDaniel. Now, that's a name I don't know off the top of my head, but it's another cenotaph, not a real grave.
It's true.
Who's Hattie McDaniel?
She's a singer, songwriter, and comedian known for her role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
I haven't seen Gone with the Wind. This is going to really tell on me for what I know and don't know and who I'm familiar with and not familiar with. I think she is also older then, but no, I'm going to say that's not close.
That one is super. That's the closest one to Chris Cornell.
Really? Wow.
It's like right over his shoulder.
Frankly, mixtaper, I don't give a dang.
Mel Blanc.
Oh, the Looney Tune.
The Looney Tune himself.
I think, yeah, he's close.
He is not.
Oh, what's up, Doc?
Jane Mansfield.
Oh, I recognize the name, but it's not properly ringing the bell all the way.
She was a rival of Marilyn Monroe.
That's probably why. Not close.
Not close is correct.
Yes.
Johnny Ramone.
Oh, also a musician. That's tough. I'm going to say that's close.
Close?
Yeah.
That is the left neighbor of Chris Cornell.
Yes.
And number one, according to this, the clear winner of this unofficial award of like best grave markers in the entire cemetery.
Really?
Johnny Ramone has a full, or I guess not full, it stops at like where his thighs are, but like from the thighs up, bust of himself shredding a guitar.
That's pretty cool. It's no Lars Ulrich toilet, but that's pretty cool.
No, it's not.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, I could keep going. There's some other ones. Peter Lorre is nearby. Nelson Eddy's nearby. Valerie Harper.
I'm going to say nearby.
It's right next to the cathedral mausoleum as well.
nearby. I'm nailing this.
Sure are.
I did win that, though.
Burt Reynolds is buried in there,
ooh,
but not nearby. Dee Dee Ramone is also in there, but not nearby. Griffith J. Griffith is in there, not nearby. Judy Garland has her own pavilion. Nowhere near. I can't believe they didn't put Toto near the Judy Garland pavilion.
Yeah, I don't know. That would make sense, wouldn't it?
Wild.
Cool. Well, I wish I'd counted that for points. I got 3 out of the 5.
You sure did, buddy.
Oh, well, that was fun. Hey.
I wasn't that prepared to play it, but...
it was just because we said the episode would be faster and weirder. I felt like it needed a fast fire facts.
It's true.
Well, Mixtaper, I'm excited to see you again next week. It'll be
something.
Well, between you and me, next week is the closest episode to Connor's birthday. And so I think he might get to pick the album. And so he'll be the one playing Factor Spin against you.
Whoa, you didn't forget his birthday this year.
No, I remembered. I won't make that mistake again. But we'll see what he picks. Anyway, we'll see you next week for that. So bring your A game and be ready to party.
I'm always ready to party.
I know you are.
I'm also always ready to yeah.
He's gone. Connor, welcome on back to the show.
You've heard of an Irish goodbye. That was a Mixtaper goodbye.
Yeah, it's like an Irish goodbye, but it's wearing a mask.
That stupid joke gets me every time.
Let's talk about the album cover of Bad Motor Finger. Really interesting. Very spiky, saw blade-y kind of.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a saw blade.
Totally.
But like, I mean, I guess the perimeter is saw blade. Like the inside, that's not how a saw blade would be designed.
No, of course not. It'd be too flimsy, but it'd be light.
I mean, they do put stress relief slots in saw blades a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Just not like that.
No, the album art was drawn by Mark Dancy, who is himself an artist and the guitarist of fellow Sub Pop band Big Chief. He's the mastermind behind this spiral-looking contraption.
It's cool. And then there's a triangle in the middle, and then what's inside the triangle?
That's a spark plug.
Oh!
To suggest a motor. You might have been the most excited about hearing the word spark plug out of anybody ever.
It's the engineer in me.
Yeah, okay.
It's a little known fact engineers are easily excited by spark plugs.
I don't know if it's so little known. It's probably easily inferred. I really love the font that they've picked out for the word Bad Motor Finger. It's very flowy and kind of a mess. Still legible, but all the letters are kind of crammed up next to each other. It's neat. I think the jagged style of it kind of fits the heavy nature of this album. You know, Saw Blade, the first song is called Rusty Cage. Like, everything feels very metal, frankly.
Like, I feel like it's meant to.
Mm-hmm. Think it's a good fit. Rusty Cage is indeed up first. What'd you think, Mr. Black Hole Sun minimal experience with Soundgarden?
Black Hole Sun.
No, that's not your... Oh,
sorry, you put it in my head.
No, I know. You gotta break your rusty cage.
Hey, my cage. I didn't let it rust, all right? I took good care of my cage.
Okay, well, Soundgarden let it rust.
How could they? I trusted them.
Well, they let you down. What did you think about the opening with that guitar part that's kind of droney, kind of loud? I don't know, it sounds like your ears are ringing when you listen to the beginning of this album.
I think this is a good tone setter track for the album.
It is. I think you get a taste of the weird tunings and the weird time signatures. This is the song, in fact, that they dropped that low E string down a fifth to a B.
Mm-hmm.
The string is way loosened. They said that they liked it because it was all wobbly. Kim Thayil said it was Chris's idea, actually, to do that. He said he wanted to get the weird tone that you can't really dial in on an amp. But they ran the guitars through a wah-wah filter, and that's how they kind of got this opening sound. And it's a perfect tone setter for those weird rhythms and time signature changes, especially at the end of the song. People have tried to be super analytical of that. Some people have said, oh, it's a mix of 3-4 and 2-4. Some people have said, oh, that's obviously 19-4. Which is
19. That's obviously 19-4.
Ridiculous. Yeah, and you know, it actually is not intentionally any of those things. It was just an accident of improvisation. They called it just completely accidental.
Improv 4.
Yeah, it's improv over 4. I like the chorus. I like how it's loud and rowdy.
Yeah, the chorus is good, but I just found myself focusing on the instruments, like the most of the song. The blomp, 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 blomp. Yeah, I was like there the whole time.
I don't blame you. It's so driven. It's so fast. Gets your heart racing right off the bat. So you didn't pay much attention to the lyrics then, huh?
No.
Well, Chris Cornell said, I wrote the lyrics in my head when we were in a van somewhere in Europe on a tour. He says he has a vivid memory staring out the window, looking at the countryside and feeling pent up. I never wrote any of the words down, but I somehow remembered them. When we finished the tour and Soundgarden returned home to Seattle, I picked up guitar and tried to come up with music that I felt matched the essence of that song. I wanted to create this hillbilly Black Sabbath crossover that I'd never heard before.
Heck yeah.
He said, if anyone can do it, Soundgarden can do it. What do you think? Did they do it? Is this hillbilly Black Sabbath?
I don't know enough Black Sabbath.
Okay.
I don't get hillbilly, though. I don't know what I get.
It's unique.
Maybe I'm getting notes of Hill, but I'm lacking the Billy.
Okay. Hill Chris.
I do get, like, country grunge more than normal grunge. Like, I think this has...
Grunge tree.
Yeah. You know, yeah, grunge tree. I like that.
It's an awful word.
I felt like Nirvana was pure, like, rock grunge, right?
Yeah, like Battery Acid.
This one has, I think, what they're trying to label as hillbilly, but I don't know what I'd call it.
I don't know either, but you know what? It's country enough. You'll never guess who covered Rusty Cage.
I'm sure a lot of people.
I mean, yeah, a lot of people have. Famously, though,
oh, hey,
Johnny Cash.
I was going to take an actual guess.
Well, you squandered your chance to actually guess.
Sad.
Yeah. Well, Johnny Cash.
That doesn't surprise me, actually.
No, the Man in Black himself.
Because Johnny Cash definitely dipped his toes into the rock country world.
He did, and it was in 1996 on his Unchained album. So it's definitely when he's experimenting with that.
A lot of metal.
Yeah. That's Rusty Cage. Great tone setter. A lot of fun. Honestly, I have so much fun with just the entire first half of this album, and that includes Outshined. Second single, Outshined was Soundgarden's first to chart on the mainstream rock charts. It peaked at number 45, and nowadays, it's gone down as one of their greatest hits. And of course, as Rusty Cage was the tone setter, Outshined is the tone continuer. Another odd time signature, another total improvisational accident. It's in 7-4. Pretty consistently.
Yeah.
And it's another instance where they retune the guitar, but it's a little less extreme. They just do it in drop D instead of drop B. So it's up a couple steps. I just love Chris Cornell's voice. You know, Rusty Cage, he kind of gets a little high and yelly, but Outshined, I think, is a chance where he really gets to go lower and grittier. He just packs a lot of punch. Got a lot of power in there.
It's Outshined by Nothing.
Nothing outshines Outshined. Chris Cornell wasn't typically one to get very personal in his lyrics, but he did open up a little bit on Outshined. He said, I don't know how everyone else feels, but I definitely go through periods of extreme self-confidence, feeling like I can do anything. He said, perhaps a fan will sense that in a performance and the hero image creeps out, but then someone will say something, however insignificant, or I'll get something in my head and all of a sudden I'm plummeting in the opposite direction and I really can't do anything about it. He said, that's where Outshined comes from and why I'll never consider myself a hero. Which is sad, all things considered. But I think maybe that's one of the reasons that Outshined has become such a staple piece of Soundgarden legacy. Actually, one of the lines he was most proud of, and one of the lines that most Soundgarden fans remember most fondly, is early on in the song, I'm looking California and feeling Minnesota. Do you like that one? Is that a good line? Certified poetry?
Looking California, feeling Minnesota?
Yeah.
I like looking California. I don't know if Minnesota was the state to pick.
I think it fits metrically. Yeah, it's
metric.
Good...
Yeah. I mean, metrically, but like...
I don't know.
Thematically? Like, is that the best state to have picked?
Maybe. He talked about looking in the mirror as he was kind of mulling over lyrics and stuff. He said, I was looking like a beach kid, as bummed as I felt. And then he came up with that line, I'm looking California and feeling Minnesota. As soon as I wrote it down, I thought it was the dumbest thing. But after the record came out and we went on tour, everybody would be screaming along with that particular line when it came up in the song. That was a shock. He said, how could anyone know that that was one of the most personally specific things I had ever written? It was just a tiny line, but somehow, maybe because it was personal, it just pushed that button. I think a lot of people out there, a lot of Soundgarden fans and just people in general, look California and feel rather Minnesota. They also did make a music video for Outshined, but it was kind of not it. They felt like it was uninspired, and the production team cut the beloved flippin' awesome guitar solo for time. So it ended up being kind of a stinker of a music video. But what are you gonna do?
Did it?
Yeah.
Stinker like bad or stinker like it was fart themed?
No, it wasn't fart themed, it was just bad. They cut the guitar solo. It's a 5-minute and 11-second song.
They have some good guitar solos on this album.
They do. One of the things I kind of noticed as I was listening through, I hope you did that thing where you pay good attention to when the tracks switch, because it's so easy to just get swept away.
I didn't on the first two. When we switched from Rusty Cage and Outshined, I didn't notice it first because it like is a seamless transition almost.
Yeah, that's what happens to me a lot on the back half of this album. We'll be going and going, and then I'll hear a hook that I'm like,
wait, that's new?
This is new, and it was too good to be also a part of the other song.
But then sometimes you hit songs like Slaves and Bulldozers where Like, they just, it's a 7-minute song, and they do introduce something new, like, partway through. And you're like, what?
It's true. Yeah, you gotta really stay on your toes. They do a lot of long songs. It's a 12-track album, which is pretty standard, but it is almost an hour long. Kind of a doozy.
Yeah.
But Slaves and Bulldozers is the longest track, but not by much. There's a moment in Slaves and Bulldozers where Kim Thayil actually blows on the strings of his guitar. He said, that's the second song we did where I blow on the guitar. I do it live and people would think I was playing with my tongue or my teeth or my beard.
What?
No, I was blowing on it. Make a wish. Yeah, he was playing the guitar by blowing on it.
Well, yeah, that part, that didn't confuse me as much as people who thought he was playing it with his beard.
The beard is weird. Tongue and teeth, like, I've seen that.
Yeah.
Beard is downright dangerous. You're going to get your hair caught in it.
Yeah.
Maybe he's got a really firm beard, I guess. I don't know. ZZ Top could probably play guitars with their beards.
Easily.
Kim Thayil also said that Slaves and Bulldozers featured one of his favorite Soundgarden guitar solos of all time.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it was kind of controversial. He said the A&R guy came in and listened to the song, and he was like, this is finished? Come on, guys. And he said, you don't get it, do you? That's it. It's finished. He said, to me, it's great. It seems free, it's real kinetic, and it gives the song this great jarring feel. He said, Slaves and Bulldozers live is when I'm real free. I just approach the fretboard with a what do I do now attitude. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it doesn't work, and that's what music is like. And I think it's also a standout track, not just for guitars and for guitar solos, but for Cornell's vocals. Wow. It's more heavy metal than previous tracks. I think we ditched the grungery. The hillbilly Black Sabbath is gone, and this is way more heavy metal. Outshine goes pretty hard too, but Slaves and Bulldozers is really where you like settle into it. He straight up screams some of these lyrics. Rick Rubin actually used this track, Slaves and Bulldozers, to convince Audioslave to let Cornell into the band down the road. They weren't sure, they were on the fence, and he said, but listen to this man. And they were like, okay, well, when you're right, you're right. Also, Slaves and Bulldozers has an interesting place in Soundgarden legacy too, because it was the closing Soundgarden song of Cornell's final performance. So its legend is really like cemented in that regard. They actually closed out that show with a cover of Led Zeppelin's In My Time of Dying, which of course is eerie because Cornell passed away a few hours after that curtain. But Slaves and Bulldozers has the honor of being the last Soundgarden track that he performed, which is really special.
That is special.
I love their guitar hooks. I know. I say it all the time. But Slaves and Bulldozers especially has some really cool moments. Ah.
It's so long.
It's a long song.
I was a bit done with it.
Yeah, and to put it this early in the album, too, is kind of a bold move.
You know, I was almost more tolerant of it that way.
Maybe that was the plan. Yeah, because it is, the album is roughly front-loaded with long songs.
Like, if I was already 53 minutes into this, and then you hit me with a 7-minute song, I'd be a little annoyed, probably. I'd be like, are we not done yet?
Like, no, but we're still getting started.
Yeah.
It is interesting that four of the album's four most popular tracks are the first four. It seems like they really put their best foot so far forward.
Yeah.
With Rusty Cage, Outshine, Slaves and Bulldozers, and then Jesus Christ Pose right after it.
Yeah. Are we ready to move on to Jesus Christ Pose?
Yeah, I think so.
I felt like I recognized the guitar part of this.
Really?
I don't know where I would have heard that. I didn't recognize anything else about the song. It's just that felt familiar, or like it reminded me of a different fast-paced guitar part. I don't know.
Interesting. It does feel kind of familiar. This song goes hard. Man, Jesus Christ Pose has all those harmonics and squeals and screeches. It's intense. Actually, interestingly, four of the members of Soundgarden contributed to Jesus Christ Pose, the most out of any track on Bad Motorfinger. People call Jesus Christ Pose the essence of the band, since it has a little bit of everybody's fingerprints on it. So I think it's cool. You know, we start out with this great introductory track, then we get into Outshined, one of their most popular songs of all time, and then we get into Slaves and Bulldozers, kind of a legendary song for them, and then Jesus Christ Pose, which encapsulates so much of their personality in one 5-minute, 51-second song. Like, that's a special start to the album. It doesn't get much better. Matt Cameron is the one who kicked things off with the writing process on the drums. He said, as soon as I started playing this pattern, everyone dove right in, and within an hour, we had the guts of the song.
Wow.
I know. He said, the approach we took on this one was pure assault of the senses. Canadians. dance to this song. I don't know what he meant by that, but they do. Thale chimed in too. He came in next. He said, Matt's drum part is insane. It's so fast and coordinated, and I picked up my guitar thinking, what are they doing? He said it took him a while to figure out what was happening, but he said he started hearing that swirly kamikaze bat sound at the beginning, and that was a groove. And then he talks a lot about how he was inspired to put the feedback on it and just doing things faster and weirder, right? That's their MO. Faster and weirder is 100% the start of Jesus Christ Pose. He's also compared the song's groove to helicopter blades, which I think I can kind of hear, especially with those drums. Lyrically, the song is about people who use religion for their own benefit, right? They pose like they're Jesus and they assume this holy posture, which is actually really exploitative, and using religion and faith as a means to profit and make money. And that goes for everyone who's leveraging fame, you know, not just in a religious sense. Cornell said you see it a lot with really beautiful people or famous people exploiting that symbol as to imply that either they're a deity or persecuted somehow by their public. So it's pretty much a song that is non-religious, but expressing being irritated by seeing that. It's kind of a complicated illustration of that situation. And actually, a lot of people who didn't listen to the song and didn't get it lyrically definitely thought that it was like a heretical kind of blasphemous song. So not their most popular. In fact, it got so much outcry from religious groups that it got pulled from MTV in 1991. It was a music video they actually liked, unlike Outshined, and people really didn't get it. They thought it was anti-Christian, and MTV was like, well, we can't have that. MTV was like, we can't have that, and they pulled it.
That's crazy.
I know, right? What do you think? I mean, we're on our second song in the span of like 12 plus minutes.
Oh, you're saying like 12 minutes have gone by when you've only done two songs?
Right, like Slaves and Bulldozers is almost 7, and Jesus Christ Pose is almost 6.
Well, I just mean, there's only two songs on here that are less than 3 minutes long.
It's true.
Or really, there are only two songs on here that are less than 4 minutes long.
Yeah, there's a significant jump. We're missing 3 minute songs, which is funny because that's such a standard length.
Yeah. It's a long album. I did find myself getting lost in the sound, usually by the last third of the songs.
Taking a walk in the sound garden?
Yeah.
Maybe that was the intent.
Out there checking on my strawberries.
Your sound plants? Sound strawberries? Yeah.
Sound strawberries, yeah.
I really think that's kind of a cool feature of the album, more than a detriment, almost.
Yeah.
That it just kind of just sweeps you away aggressively.
It'd be great workout music. Get your blood pumping because of how fast-paced it is and everything, but yet not distracting from your workout. Mm-hmm. I could see this being workout music.
Yeah, it's that full-on assault to the senses.
Or if you're really are hardcore, like yoga.
Yoga?
Just for the hardcore yogaers out there. You know, most people think of yoga, it's like serene and peaceful.
You'd be so stressed out.
And then you got like this one person who's got their earbuds in and they're just...
You know, I bet this would be good for yoga specifically if you're doing a Jesus Christ pose. I don't think that's a real yoga move. That's not a regulation yoga move. Not certified, but...
Certified to hear it spin it.
Maybe.
What would be the spin it yoga pose?
I don't know. What kind of a question is that?
I'm just imagining something where, like, you've got, like, maybe, like, a winding of your arm or something. I don't know. Yogis usually strike a pose and hold it. We're all about keep spinning, like, keep moving. Like,
yeah.
I don't think we align with yoga very well.
I think we'd be a spin class.
Now, like, one of those biking... What's the biking classes?
The spin class.
Yeah, the spin class.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's our healthy market right there. We gotta get in with the jazzercisers. Not jazzercise, the biker. No, the spin classers. Jazzercise is also one I think we'd be good at.
I can see it.
What were we talking about?
Yeah, see, we got lost on yoga. We were talking about how long these songs were and how there are only two songs on the album less than 4 minutes. One of them happens to be track 5. Face Pollution! Face Pollution.
Oh, I didn't hear you the first time, sorry.
I said Face Pollution.
That was a joke because you yelled it and it was very loud.
Yeah, I know, because he yells it so much in the song.
Yeah.
It feels wrong not to yell it.
But then you said it again, normal, and so I was like, oh, I act like I didn't hear it the first time as a joke, but then I think you thought I actually didn't hear it.
I think Face Pollution starts out awesome. It sounds big and sweeping and just as fast as anything we've heard so far. It's just so intense. For its 2 minutes and 23 seconds, it's one of the most action-packed, like, dense stretches of music on the record. It's a song about identity, kind of akin to The Stranger or other similar songs that we've covered. And some of the lyrics are a little off the rails. Not like in a bad way, just in a way that makes you go, huh. If you take them outside of the context of the song, some of the lyrics of Face Pollution are really something. I'm numb as rigor mortis, scared by monkey faces, drowned in shark fins.
That's pretty poetic.
Yeah, it is. Of course, most of the lyrics are just face pollution, feel. I don't feel like feeling is pretty good. I do like that one.
I mean, this one was over before I knew it.
You blink and it's done.
I've gotten so used to these, I mean, 5, 6, 7 minute songs.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like, here's 2 minutes, 23 seconds, a fast paced, just everything. And now we're gone.
You almost don't even have a chance to settle into it before it's passed you by.
Uh-huh.
And what's funny is, I mean, it's got almost the least amount of Spotify plays on the album, which you'd think it would be the easiest to just hit real quick, you know? Seems not to be the case. You can't listen to this album and not be in awe of the drums. How he can keep up and keep that tempo.
Yeah, I mean, the drums are good, but I keep fanboying the guitar. I'm kind of pulling a U.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Face Pollution's all right. I like it.
Yeah, it knows what it wants to deliver, and it does it fast and succinctly.
And weirdly. Faster and weirder.
Faster and weirder.
It's ear pollution.
We are. We're getting faster and weirder.
You're right.
But then we slow it back down.
I think if you want to talk about weirder, the start of Somewhere is very strange. It's so yelly. He just starts out with this, I wish to wish and I dream to dream, like very meta kind of stuff. And he's yelling and it's loud. And then they cut into singing it. But the yelling at the beginning is really interesting.
You're the wow!
Yeah, feels like you're pounding on the wall, trying to get let out of something. I don't know. I think this song has some of the most unbelievable lyrics on the album. And I kind of think Somewhere is like a harbinger of what's coming for Soundgarden, right? If you want to move towards something like Black Hole Sun, Somewhere sounds like kind of a way that you could bridge that gap between what we've heard so far and what's coming. It's a lot more melodic. It's a little slower and a little bit softer, but not at the expense of intensity. But lyrically, right? The willow weeps on roses for the dead in laughs of love. Like, good grief, is this the same guy that just wrote the thing about swimming in shark fins? Somewhere in my dreams, the skies hold still. It's like on another level. Somewhere is one of my favorite songs lyrically.
This was one that actually got me listening to the lyrics. I found myself listening to the vocals on this one.
Yeah, it's easy to when the guitar line follows that melody right along with it on the chorus. Somewhere in my dreams, like that's exactly the same. And it's, again, great song to listen to the lyrics on. You picked a good one.
I know how to pick them.
Yeah, it feels a lot less involved, I think, from a musical standpoint. There's not as much of a wall of sound kind of thing going on. And it's almost a normal length. Two kind of shorter songs back to back.
On most albums, this would be considered a longer one, but it's actually,
yeah, I know,
one of the more shorter ones.
On some albums, there aren't even tracks as long as this that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Here, I'm looking. Is it like the third or fourth shortest?
Yeah, I think it's fourth.
Yeah.
There's two-minute tracks, one 4 minute, 6 second track, and then this one coming in at 4:21.
Well, this one is pretty close to tied for the shortest title of a song. Just gets 9 letters. The next two tracks are some of the longest, kind of clunkiest titles on the album. Like, now we're going to talk about Searching With My Good Eye Closed by Soundgarden from the album Bad Motor Finger. Like, so much. So many syllables.
Yeah. And then, like, if, like, asking, like, Alexa to play or something, you know, they always have that weird voice where they pronounce words slightly, either differently or, like, put the emphasis differently than us humans would talk. I can just, like, imagine the cadence.
Right.
You'd be like, Alexa, play Searching With My Good Eyes Closed, remastered by Soundgarden. Anybody that was listening to this on a speaker that has an Alexa just got triggered. Get wrecked. Ha ha.
Ha ha. Hope you get to listen to the song now.
But then Alexa would be like, now playing Searching With My Good Eyes Closed, remastered by Soundgarden. You know, it's like, it'd be such a lengthy process just to start this song.
It would.
Not very good time management with all the syllables here.
I bet that was their plan, to waste people's time with Alexa.
Oh, they got us.
You know, Alexa, Amazon's based in Seattle. Soundgarden's based in Seattle.
It's all coming together.
Jinx. Wow. Searching With A Good Eye Closed.
It's another one that starts weird.
It does. It's a minute and 20 seconds in. It's like quiet noises and screams escalating from the abyss. Like,
yeah.
Interesting. This song to me kind of feels a little Foo Fighter-y. I think I can see very clearly the connection between Soundgarden, Nirvana, you know, the Cornells and the Grohls of the world on a sound like Searching With My Good Eye Closed. Conceptually, you know, I've never heard the phrase before or outside of this context, searching with a good eye closed, but it's a phrase that means that you're being like willfully impaired as you're on the hunt for something, kind of implying that you don't want to find it, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking for this. I'd rather not have it, but I have to look. And so I'm going to close my good eye and just try and minimize the chances that I run across it. I'm on my way looking for the paradigm so I can pass it off. Is it on my side? Who knows? It's so funny, too, the contrast. I mean, the front half of the album was so heavy and so fast and so much. And the back half of the album, to this point, from Somewhere to Searching With My Good Eye Closed, really feels like we mellowed out a lot.
This one's, it sounds like he was standing farther back from the microphone as well on a lot of the vocals.
Interesting. I think they just put a lot of reverb on him.
Or, like, it felt like it was recorded maybe in a stadium. Or, you know, it had, like, this bigger sound to it, in my opinion.
I get that. Yeah, definitely sounds like a stadium appropriate slow jam. Which eye is your good eye? What's your dominant eye? Do you know?
I do know.
Which eye? Don't dox yourself, but which eye is your dominant eye?
Wait, what?
I said don't dox yourself, but which eye is your dominant eye?
I don't know if I want to reveal that information. That might be too much power in the hands of strangers.
I'll bleep it.
Oh, I don't know if I trust you to bleep it.
Oh, I'll bleep it.
I feel like you were setting me up there to just completely leave it unbleeped.
No, I'll bleep it.
Yeah, no, I am dominant.
Okay, you're right, I dominant.
Oh, come on. Okay, I didn't see that one coming.
I'm right, I dominant too.
Yeah, quit being such a copycat. Be your own eye.
I guess I am a copycat. You were right, I dominant first.
That's right, I was.
Ooh, should we tell him? Audience, if you want to test which eye of yours is dominant and find out which eye you'd have to close to search without the good eye,
put both your eyes into a steel cage match and see which one wins.
No, don't make your eyes fight. What you do is you hold your arms out in front of you and put some object in a diamond of your fingers. Make a diamond with your fingers, put some object in the middle and look at it. And then slowly bend your elbows to bring the diamond towards your face. And whatever eye your hands end up in front of, just naturally, don't like force it, because you can obviously make it go either way. But whatever eye your diamond ends up in front of is your dominant eye.
It's hard to do and not accidentally force.
It depends.
I was never good at that test.
If you think about it too much, it's a mistake. It's a test you can't really fail.
I a lot of times ended up just right in the middle between both eyes.
Oh, you just brought it straight back intentionally. That's not the point.
No, not intentionally. I was like trying to do the test and it would just not drift one way or the other.
You got stable retraction on your elbows.
That's right, I do. It's the engineer in me.
Sure.
It's another lesser known thing about engineers. Stable retraction.
Dominant nose. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm nose dominant, according to that test.
Yeah, you smelled the object. Let's talk about Room a Thousand Years Wide. You know, we talked about Jesus Christ Pose and how it's a contribution from all the members of the band. A Room a Thousand Years Wide is kind of the opposite. This one's got music by drummer Matt Cameron and lyrics by Kim Thayil. So it's a rare Chris Cornell-less write. He's not got songwriting credits on this one. Thayil said, I really liked the music to the song and it needed words. And since no one else pursued it, I decided to. It's not really about things that have actually happened to me. It's more about experience in general. I've heard a lot of good ideas from people telling me what it's about. They said it's about God, Satan, Jesus, Satan, both. It's religious, it isn't religious. The truth is, it's just me. That's what he says. The main lyric, Room a Thousand Years Wide, came from a movie, actually, as part of some kind of witch incantation.
Which movie?
You know, I don't know which movie.
It was a witch movie.
One of them. Yeah, a witch movie. That's right. This was also the first recording to feature Ben Shepherd, or at least the single version they released before re-recording it for Bad Motor Finger was the first recording to feature Ben Shepherd. So that's fun. Room a Thousand Years Wide also gets some new instrumental features that we haven't seen, a bit of new texture for Bad Motor Finger. There's a small trumpet and saxophone horn section in 6/4 time.
I love it.
You just never know how to count a Soundgarden song.
6/4 is really just 3/2. I know how to reduce fractions.
That's true. It is 3/2, but...
But also, like, not.
Not really. Yeah. I want to see them mess around with 3/4 more.
3/4 is fun.
It's fun, but they're doing 6/4 and 9/4 and 2... You know what I mean? I want more waltz time heavy metal songs. That's exactly how it would sound. Think of how fun that would be.
I had the Connors Hippin' and Hoppin' album. A grunge waltz.
Great. That'll fit right in.
Called a wunge.
Wunge?
I was going to say grultz, but that felt worse.
It'd be a regular Mind Riot. Mind Riot is up next. Track 9, moving right along.
It's what happens when the mind party gets out of control.
Yeah, the mind's riot. They keep the low string on its usual E. They don't drop tune anything, well, there. But this is absurd. If you play guitar, you know how absurd this is. They tune every other string to E as well. They're playing an E-tuned guitar.
I noticed that, because, you know, I'm an instrumentalist.
Yeah, Not a guitarist, though. That's the point that I was trying to make earlier.
That's not what you said earlier. You said instrumentalist.
Yeah, but I meant.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you meant. You may have meant to say guitarist, but in your heart of hearts, you meant instrumentalist. That's why you said it.
Yeah, that's okay. True. Man, where were you helping me out when the mixtaper and I played Factor Spin the other week with the All-American Rejects?
I get kicked out, remember?
It's true, but that kind of argument would have come in handy.
Sure would have.
Apparently, the idea to tune the guitar to all E everywhere came from Pearl Jam bassist Jeff Ament as a joke, but Chris Cornell took the joke and ran with it, and he's like, I'm gonna do it, making every string E. Mind Riot was written after the death, actually, of Chris Cornell's friend Andrew Wood, and it kind of functions both as a song of grief and as a tribute to their friendship and what it was. You can hear it very plainly in some of the lyrics. Candle was burning yesterday like somebody's best friend died. I've been caught in Mind Riot. I was crying from my eye teeth. Ew.
That is gross.
Wonder if the good eye or the bad eye has the teeth. But crying from my eye teeth, bleeding from my soul, and I sharpened my wits on a dead man's skull. So again, trademark, patent, Soundgarden, dark imagery.
Bleh.
But twisted and bent into this context of loss and pain and grief in a really raw way. Mind Riot is one of the most interesting songs on this album, I think. In terms of like what stands out as something that's very unique, Mind Riot is kind of on its own little island in my head.
I can see that.
It's kind of got that same slow cadence of Somewhere. It's a lot cleaner than something like Outshined or Drawing Flies. It's not screamy like Holy Water. It's just very much more like contemplative, I think. And then we come to another of the album's short tracks.
Drawing Flies.
Not even 2.5 minutes again.
I mean, it doesn't take very long to draw a fly. I mean, it's a pretty small creature. It's not like trying to draw an elephant or something.
No. Yeah, but not drawing like attracting flies.
No, you know? No.
Drawing Flies is actually a really memorable late album track for me. I remember kind of going through a slag in the middle of this album where nothing was sticking for most of the time I listened to it. Once we get past like Jesus Christ Poser, Face Pollution, I lost a lot of it for a long time.
Sure.
Drawing Flies got me back.
Okay.
And I just think that's because I remember some of these lyrics. It's about someone who's just rotting away, you know, sitting idle, stuck in a rut, time's passing uneventfully, sitting here like wet ashes with X's in my eyes, drawing flies, like uninvited company, wallowing in my own obscenity. There's just some more really intense, I don't know if I want to say like captivating, but they're lyrics that jump out at you when you listen. You go, he said what?
I mean, that's been true like this whole album, but especially on this track.
Yeah, fair. No doubt. But I really like them, right? Leaning on a pedestal that holds my self-denial. Like, he can't even bother to put himself on the pedestal or support himself at all, really, because his self-denial comes first and foremost. And he relies on that to get him through, even though he knows and clearly acknowledges here that it's detrimental. All in a 2-minute song. It's so much. You know, when we talked about Face Pollution, it was short, and there were not very many lyrics and not much going on in that song. This song, it's a small novel of lyrics and verses. There's quite a few lyrics jam-packed into this, and it's the same length, pretty much spot on. And I also like how I kind of disregard rhythm for a lot of the verses. They just kind of just go as fast and as hard as they can. Syllables and emphasis doesn't matter as much until we get to X's in my eyes, drawing flies. It makes the song feel paranoid, I think. And I think that suits it really well. Holy Water is the next to last track on the album.
At this point, I was in that mind-numbed state.
The Mind Riot.
Yeah, the Mind Riot got me.
I kind of assumed you would be. This is the kind of album that, I mean, obviously lends itself to that, but even if it didn't, I feel like on a lot of albums that are this style and this length, we're past the point where it starts to get you.
Sure.
Historically speaking. Holy Water is interesting. It's the return of religious imagery, but in a way more direct context than Jesus Christ Pose, right? That we talked about as a metaphor or kind of a storytelling device to give you an idea of different situations through the same context of people abusing like religious power or authority. Holy Water is way more of a direct telling of a story, and it does get even darker. The speaker has this traumatic encounter and is like sexually assaulted by someone he trusts and who's respected in the religion, some kind of religious authority, a priest, what have you. And so we get this really, really interesting image. Holy water is rusting me. Like this thing that's supposed to be pure and blessed and like heal me even is doing exactly the opposite and is fundamentally corroding me. Probably one of the most like lasting, I think, images on this album.
Holy Water. I enjoyed the like wailing vocals.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
It is. His voice reminds me of something on Holy Water, and I can't put my finger on it. Not the screaming part that you're talking about, just the lower verses where he almost kind of mumbles it a little bit. You know what I mean? It's reminding me of something I can't think of right now. But the range he shows on this song is incredible and frankly unparalleled on the album. From one extreme all the way up to the other. Like, it's a lot. And at the drop of a hat. There's some really interesting harmony on Holy Water too. Like screamed harmony. Up Last is the third longest song on the album.
Last, but definitely not least.
Well, least in Spotify plays, but not least in our hearts, probably. That's New Damage.
It was actually kind of least. I retract my earlier statement.
Last and least, it's New Damage. I mean, if you like New Damage, that's its own thing. But it's clearly the least popular on the album. Essentially, you know, it's a new kind of damage. It's going to tear the world apart in ways it hasn't seen before. Very weirdly fictional. I think a lot of these songs have been based in real emotions and real situations, even if they haven't been very personal all the time. At least they're like grounded. New Damage kind of feels like it goes off the rails a little bit, and it kind of reminded me of like Metallica and some of the stuff we saw in Master of Puppets with the Lovecraftian horrors and the things that are but should not be. You know what I mean?
Sure.
New Damage is a different kind of song. Faceless Poison, A New World Order, The Wreck's Going Down, Get Out Before You Drown. It's funny that it's the least popular song on the album because I really do like that chorus.
It's just, it was too long. It didn't do an, like, the other longer ones tried to keep it fresh a little bit. This one was, didn't keep it fresh for me.
No, I get that. And it's, again, been 50 plus minutes of more or less this album. You've been doing a great job. You know what I mean? At this point in the album, you're like, wow, I've really been through a lot of Soundgarden right now. So New Damage kind of just acts like a capstone on it for me. It's just the last little bit of everything that I liked from the album. And I don't think it's really anything that I didn't like, but it feels like it's just a recap of all the stuff, all the elements that came in other tracks that I really enjoyed, wrapped up in one little package. Well, not little, one big, big, big package.
One big, big package.
Almost 6 minutes.
Almost 6 minutes worth of package.
That's right. But with that, I suppose it is time once again for that part of the episode where we spin finally. Final spin.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I've got to get all your thoughts about this album, how it compares to Nirvana, to a lesser extent, the Foo Fighters. I'm excited. For me, musically, it's all right. A lot of the choruses are really good and memorable. This is classic 1991 grunge. I really enjoy it. I think I'm giving the music a 79. I think a lot of the songs in the middle can kind of get lost. The time signature changes and stuff are really fun. There's a lot of them. And I guess they're kind of less of like a creative implementation and more so like we talked about and like the band acknowledges, kind of like creative accidents. Like they heard the song going this way, so they decided to play it that way, which is fine. But I'm giving the music a 79. Lyrics, 82. On the dark side, really, but also sometimes on the silly kind of side, especially if you decontextualize them. Like when I took some notes, I would sometimes sit down and just read the lyrics without music. There are some real interesting ones in there without the context and the power of Chris Cornell's vocals behind them. Given lyrics in 82. Instruments and production, 76. This album is heavy and it's sharp and it's grating. Not in a bad way, in the kind of grating way that you'd want from a grunge album. But this album is kind of exhausting. I think this album makes you work to get through it.
Gotcha.
And a lot of that's just due to the production and like the listening fatigue. You know, there's a lot of feedback and a lot of ringing and a lot of grunge distortion. And I think if you were to break this album apart track by track, I don't think there's a single spot where you'd find it offensive or wrong or bad, you know what I mean? It's just that together in 1 hour-long collection like this, and maybe it's just the remaster, you know? We've mostly listened to the remastered version of this album, so maybe the original mix is better, but 76 for that. Overall, such an important album in like the history and evolution of grunge and metal music. I really gotta respect that. I think this isn't necessarily the kind of thing I always seek out or go for, but definitely scratches the itch. So I'm giving it an 81 for overall vibe.
Fair enough.
Which puts its overall score at an 81.0. 81 even. Landing it, for our podcast, at 491 overall. Right below Parallel Lines by Blondie. And right above Wu-Tang Clan, which we did for episodes 63 and 117 respectively. So I guess every 60-ish episodes... we end up in this neighborhood. Well, 50? I don't know. It's been a while since we've been in this ballpark, but that's where it is.
Fair enough.
How about you? Final thoughts on Bad Motorfinger?
I really like Black Hole Sun.
Yeah. Uh-oh. That's not a good first final thought.
What? So I just had to get it out there.
Yeah. Well, it just makes me feel like you're saying that to justify what you're about to say.
I also liked this album.
That's good. Yeah.
I don't know how much I'll return to it. It was also a bit long. But there's a couple songs on here that I'll enjoy when they pop up on the favorite songs playlist.
That's good.
My top three, and I believe I only get three.
You sure do. You obviously picked more than your fair share on Adele.
Yeah.
An album that you wanted to bring yourself.
Yeah. So my top three in album order, Rusty Cage.
Okay.
Outshined. And Slaves and Bulldozers.
What, one, two, three. From the top three.
Top three from the top three.
Right in order. Hey, I'll tell you what. Early birthday present, you can take your honorable mention.
No.
Huh?
No.
No, why not? It's a birthday gift.
I'm banking that birthday gift for my birthday episode.
That's not how this works.
Why would I want my birthday present early? Give it to me for my birthday episode. What?
Well, your actual birthday present is that you get to pick the album for the next episode.
Well, consider it last year's birthday present that you still owe me.
Fine. Last year's 51-week late birthday present. You could take your honorable mention.
No.
Because I'm curious to hear what it is, too.
Oh, okay. So you just want to know.
I do want to know.
And you're trying to make it seem like you're giving me something when really I'm giving you something.
It's a transactional. It's an exchange.
So if you want to know my honorable mention this week, you got to agree that I can have an extra pick next week for free. Extortion.
Dealing?
Yeah, I'm extorting my honorable mention.
Fine. Sure. Whatever.
Who's Jesus Christ pose? It's 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's the first four.
Yeah.
See, that's what I said, though. The first four are a really special run of tracks.
Yeah, and the rest of it, not so much.
That's not true. They don't all have the legacy and the lore of the first four tracks, but there's still some gems down there.
As for a score, this one's getting 5 Toto Cenotaphs out of 10.
There's only one, though.
Only one at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, but there's 5 in our hearts.
Sure. A 5. Ooh, we haven't been in 5 territory. Well, I guess the Grammy episode on Midnight's got a 5.
Yeah.
But other than that, wow, we haven't been in the 5 territory since before the Year of Healing, since the Grady's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd scratch that. Miranda Lambert got a 5.
And it's funny because both the ones you forgot got a 5. Are our book ending where this one's going. This one's going right between Midnight's and Weight of these Wings.
Interesting. Really? Below Midnight's?
Yeah.
I feel like you had a real distaste for Midnight's.
Yeah. I think I won't be back here. And I can acknowledge that Midnight's on a technical level was really good.
I guess. I think if you're looking at like the spectrum of all music, your general preferences are a little closer to where Midnight's is than this.
I don't know, because I really like rock, which this would be closer to, but...
Yeah.
I don't know, I just really like Black Hole Sun.
Okay, we get it.
I think this would be an interesting one to backtrack, because I think I might have liked that album better.
Really? You know, I haven't actually listened to the other album.
Oh.
With Black Hole Sun.
So maybe you should put it on your albums of the month, and then we can do a backtrack for it.
Yeah, super unknown, huh? Maybe I'll have to give it a go.
Maybe you'll backtrack too and be like, we should have picked that one.
I don't know. I really like Bad Motorfinger.
Only time will tell.
Yeah.
Playlist pick. Probably go in Rusty Cage.
Okay, that's fair. So Rusty Cage is your playlist pick. I think that makes my job really hard.
You're welcome.
Can I be honest? I'm really seriously contemplating taking Slaves and Bulldozers.
I mean, go for it. Unlike someone on this podcast, I don't limit what you're allowed to take.
No, but look in California, feel in Minnesota. Ah, or something deeper cut, like Somewhere. Oh, it's so hard to pick. I think I'm going to take Slaves and Bulldozers for how much Kim Thayil liked it and talked about loving that solo, playing it live and feeling free and uninhibited. I think Slaves and Bulldozers is a pretty cool song, so we'll go with that, even though it's long.
Fair enough.
And at least it's long without any dull moments. You know, like New Damage and Holy Water, like some of the stuff starts out long with like a long intro section or some lull moments. I don't think Slaves and Bulldozers has any of those. But that's going to do it for another episode of Spin It. In another year with Connor at his current age, everyone say goodbye to, I guess not say goodbye to 2024 Connor. He'll still be here.
Yeah.
Current age Connor will be born anew in the next episode.
Like the Phoenix.
Yeah. Connor's birthday is next week. He gets to pick the album.
Yeah.
I still don't know what it is. So
yeah,
we'll find out.
I did listen to half of the things I'm considering today. I got the other half to listen to tomorrow, and then a decision will be made.
Okay. So you know as much as I do, audience.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I mean, you know basically as much as I do. I don't know what we're doing either.
That's true. Nobody knows what album's coming next week, so stay tuned for that. I'm excited, probably, and you should be too. You can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. Be sure to like, rate, subscribe, give some stars, give some thumbs. You can find us on social media, at Spin It Pod Official on Instagram and at Spin It Pod on X. And of course, you can find us on the web at www.spinitpod.com. Tune in next week to hear Connor say funny things like this.
Oh, I forget that. I forgot that was a thing.
And tell a friend.
Is that what we're going with? I feel like I can do better than that.
Okay. Stay tuned next time to hear Connor do better than that with phrases like this.
I can't do better than that.
Tell a friend who's got a polluted face and eye teeth about the podcast, I guess.
Sorry, what was that a reference to?
Well, the polluted face was a reference to face pollution, and the eye teeth was a reference to that awful lyric in Mind Riot.
Tell a friend who you would name a black hole after.
Ooh, yeah, that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week, and until then,
keep spinning. Don't stop. Keep spinning. You know, one more rep. I don't know how they do spin classes. I don't know.
You've never been to a spin class in your life.
No.
One more rep.
I don't know.
Spin class. Sure. What do you think? I think that was pretty much faster and weirder than the usual episode.
I don't know about faster, but it was definitely weirder.
I don't know about weirder, but it was definitely at least as weird. How about that? It was as fast and as weird.
We didn't under-deliver.
No.
But we may not have over-delivered. Who knows?
You don't want to over-deliver.
It's true. Although I'd be pretty happy if I ordered, like, an ice cream cone and they gave me two.
Until they gave you five or six and they all started to melt.
I'd still be pretty happy. But that might just be me.